Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. Are you sitting comfortably? Good, then I'll begin. Once upon a time, there was a journalist, travel writer, and award-winning author, Nicholas Jubber. He travelled across the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and Europe, documenting the lives of nomads in North Africa and researching medieval physicians in Venice. The Fairy Tellers is his fifth book, which offers a fresh perspective on some of our most well-known stories and recounts their provenance for the contemporary reader. Filled with adventure, tragedy, and real-world magic, this bewitching book uncovers the strange lives behind the strangest of tales. Nicholas, welcome to Monocle Reads.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is an absolutely fascinating book, a journey into the secret history of fairy tales, because, of course, we don't really think about where a fairy tale comes from, or indeed that there might be a real person behind it. But that's a journey that you set out on, and many amazing discoveries. How did you come to that point where you suddenly started thinking about the people behind those stories?
Well, I think fairy tales have been sort of bubbling around in my head really all through my life, back from childhood, from being fascinated by them, reading the first reading memories I have of reading stories like The Snow Queen, Under the Duvet with a Torch. And then later on as a student, I was still interested in fairy tale characters and I wrote plays about them. And then with my own children, reading stories and finding some of the lesser known stories and then also retelling some of the well-known ones and mixing them up. And I kept finding myself with these questions bubbling in my head. Who told these stories? Who shaped them? How did they come to be the particular stories that we know today? And although there is that idea of stories being so universal, for example, Cinderella can crop up in every single country around the world, but when you go back into the history of these stories, I found that there were very specific qualities to them. I mean, if you take the earliest version of Cinderella, for example, which was written down in 19th century China, the idea of Cinderella's foot being so small that she can fit the feet is to do with the foot-binding culture that was prevailing in the Tang Dynasty at that time. And then when you go to the first European version, which was where she was given that name that we have today, Cenerentola. This is an Italian version, which then became Cinderella in French, and then Cinderella in English. And that version took on a very, very specific qualities of the Neapolitan Italian culture with the feast. They're served ravioli and ricotta-filled pastries. And so I was interested in how these stories move around. They move from one place to another, but they take on something in the roots of the places that they become absorbed into, and then are often very, very closely shaped by those places. I also wanted to look at some of the people who had formed new tales. So, for example, there's a section in the book about Hans Christian Andersen, and of course he was this incredible genius with this incredible imagination to come up with his own new fairy tales, but they absorbed very specific qualities of his own life. So a story like The Little Mermaid, which feels very universal in many ways, but it's a very direct response to his own experience of moving from the poverty of life in Odense to Copenhagen and feeling that he lost his voice in the process and that he wasn't really listened to because he was seen as a sort of provincial yokel and he had to find a new way of expressing himself. And that is very much, in some ways, the experience of The Little Mermaid. So I was fascinated by how, as you dig into these stories, you see the lives of the tellers being braided into the tales that they told.
Because, I mean, for the modern day consumer of fairy or reader of fairy tales, quite often they follow a formula. I mean, we start with Once Upon a Time. There are various kind of plot points that we always have. And then it often ends after meeting the handsome prince that you live happily ever after. How has it come to that, that they've become so formulaic?
Yeah, well, that refers back to the oral culture that they came out of, because you need those formulas as oral storytellers to be able to keep that story together and to be able to remember all the different parts of the template of the story. And that's something that comes into each of the storytellers that I focused on in this book. It goes back to that oral culture. So the first teller is Gian Battista Basile, who put together Europe's first fairy tale collection, first integral fairy tale collection. And he was collecting stories from various places around Italy. He had a very rambunctious life, moved around the courts and met people in the various places that he went to, in Naples, Mantua, Avellino, the Basilicata, and collected the stories that people told him. He also went to Crete as a soldier and fought against the Turks, and he learnt stories there as well. And so you can hear the voice of that oral culture coming through with those formulas that he uses, and that comes through many of the different storytellers. One of the storytellers I focused on is Dorchenwild, who lived in Kassel at the time of the Brothers Grimm. And we have this image of the Brothers Grimm as these sort of folklorists who went around the villages collecting stories. But actually, they collected stories mostly from their neighbours, who were mostly working to middle-class young women who were friends of theirs. And one of them, Dorchenwild, who told them Rumpelstiltskin, The Six Swans, probably Hansel and Gretel, and many, many other brilliant tales. she told them these stories in a sort of salon gatherings, and was also in love with Wilhelm Grimm, and they used to meet in quite intimate settings sometimes where she would tell him stories. And there's a lovely story about how she and Wilhelm eventually came together and were married and had children together. And so there's the storytelling seems to have been one of the things that really brought them together. But this is all comes back to that question of yours about the oral culture, that they needed, because a lot of these people weren't necessarily professional storytellers as we would understand it today. So they needed these phrases, these templates to be able to use, to be able to not sort of get lost in the story. Because you can, if you're trying to tell a story and you're not completely sure of how you're going, you can very easily get lost and then not quite know how to work your way out. But they're also brilliant. Yeah, brilliant phrases that come in. One of my favourites is in the Russian stories, where there's a particular stock phrase where the teller at the end of the story says, "I was there, I drank honey beer, none got in my mouth, it all went down my beard." And it's a sort of rhyming phrase that they often end the stories with. And it's the idea that the storyteller will deliver this brilliant story, but they never really get much of a reward for it. And that, sadly, is often the case with many of the storytellers that I've focused on in the book.
I wonder where the need for stories comes from. And I don't just mean that sort of need for humans to be creative, but the fact that these stories have a use beyond entertainment, that they are cautionary tales, or that they are a way of reminding people of history.
They are. They do have these uses, and they have been put to various different uses. But I think there's a fascinating conflict that's been going on throughout history between the stories themselves, which are very agile. They're able to move around and be reinterpreted and retold by different generations and in different countries, different cultures, different milieus. And at the same time, morality, which also is very agile and shifting constantly. And so they're in this sort of strange dance where they're moving around each other, the morals and the stories, and often the stories are trying to elude the morality. You have these sort of wonderful, to take, for example, one of the Middle Eastern stories of Aladdin, the story is that he's a lazy good-for-nothing who won't do anything until he gets himself lost in a cave, rubs a lamp, and then suddenly there's a magical genie who's able to make him incredibly rich. And some people have questioned, is that really a good morality? But you could argue that the point of the story is that once you have wealth, then you can actually do something with it. Until you do, there's no prospects. One of the deepest stories, but one that's very controversial in many ways, is Beauty and the Beast, where you have this story and people have said, oh, this is Stockholm Syndrome, you know, that she's a prisoner of this very angry, potentially violent beast, and she's forced against her will to live with him. But another way of reading that story is that actually, and I think one of the reasons why that story has been so attractive to specifically female retellers, it's probably one of the most retold stories in history, is that it's the shift of the power dynamic, that it starts with Belle as the prisoner of the beast, but it ends with she being the one who has the power to save his life. Mm. And it's that sense that she's able to see beyond the surface and to understand that behind the beast there is a genuine person. And he is able to connect with her and to see her as more than just his prisoner. And that she ultimately becomes the one who has that power to decide whether he should survive. And in the original version, which I think is by far the most fascinating version, written by Gabrielle Susan de Villeneuve in 1740, it comes to a climax with Belle consciously choosing. It's not just that she's in love with him. She makes a very conscious decision that she will save his life. So the power is very much in her hands. And I think that's one of the reasons why that story has such an audience.
Mm. I mean, as the mother of a daughter, I remember from when she was little, always saying, listen, this whole happily ever after and then she meets her handsome prince is not necessarily true. And of course, that is a message that is reinforced to our little girls quite often in those stories of helpless women, of people, girls who always have to be saved, and so on. And that gradually shifts, and you zone in on some amazing female storytellers.
But it's not, I think it's not just that it shifts, but actually, if we go further back, we find that it wasn't necessarily there at the beginning. So if we go back to the Italian stories told by Giambattista Basile, some of the women in his stories, and he's very much a man of his time, there's a lot of misogyny in the stories, but at the same time the women are vocal, they express themselves. So the story of the flea, for example, you have a princess called Porziella who's forced to marry an ogre because her father has put up a giant flea skin on the palace walls and said whoever can identify it will get to marry his daughter, and the ogre is the only person who can, so she has to go live in the woods with this ogre. But she shouts at her father, she says I don't want to do this, this is not my choice, I don't want to have to marry him, and she's furious. Another story by Basile has a woman whose lover is injured in a secret tunnel that they have to meet each other. And so she goes out into the woods and she kills an ogre because the ogre's lard is the only thing that can cure his wounds. So there are these wonderful stories of very self-determining women, you know, with their own agency who absolutely sort of drive their own plots. But then later on, as as morality changed towards the sort of Victorian morality and that idea of female modesty, and as that became, and that obviously had always been there and it came back and forth in different degrees, but it really took over, particularly in the 19th century. And so you can see that in the stories of the Brothers Grimm as the heroines become much quieter and more docile. But there's a brilliant group of female fairy tellers in the 1690s, led by a woman called Baroness d'Ornano, who's probably the person who came up with the term fairy tale, Conte de Fées in the original French. And she wrote some fantastic stories about really determined women who are fantastically active. There's a story called Finette Cendron where the heroine, it's a sort of Cinderella tale. She ends up in an ogre's house and she kills the ogre with a hatchet and then pushes another one into an oven. And then when her sisters go off to party at the ball and leave her behind to do all the sweeping, she goes to the ball anyway by herself. She doesn't have a fairy godmother. She just finds some clothes and off she goes. And at the end, she gets to marry the prince. But because she says, I want my family who had lost their kingdom, I want their kingdom to be restored first. So there's a sense that she wants to meet on equal levels. Mm. And there are many of these stories which were told. That was in a particularly sort of aristocratic female environment. And then there are other ways in which these stories have come through. But even if you come through to some storytellers who have often been maligned as not necessarily being as progressive as we would like them to be today. You know, you look at somebody like Hans Christian Andersen, who's gone out of fashion very much. But actually, if you look at a story like The Snow Queen, for example, which was retold as Frozen by Disney, so they turned the main character in, they turned them into princesses in the Disney version. But actually, if you go back into the original version, Gerda just lives in an ordinary town. Her friend Kai is an ordinary boy and who gets a shard of ice in his heart, as you do, and ends up stuck in the Snow Queen's palace. And she goes out to find him and rescue him. And I think it's a wonderful story about this young girl who's determined to find her friend and to save him and bring him back, whatever the cost. Mm.
So why do we so often focus, or why are characters so often royalty, or there doesn't seem to be anything in between. It's royalty or peasant, or indeed ogres. And what's the origin story, if you like, of them?
Well, I think a lot of these stories came from a time where there were obviously much more stratified class divisions. And so there was that sense of you know, not so much of a middle class. And they go back to those sort of feudal times. And a lot of our fairy tales are stuck in that medieval atmosphere. So one of the points I make in the book is that our image of fairy tales in Europe especially is very much from medieval times, hence the spinning wheels and the castles with the turrets and the princesses in the pointy hats. Mm. And all those stock images, they're very much the images of medieval iconography, medieval literature. So it's why I think that it's often very interesting when we find fairy tales from outside of the European, the sort of Western European milieu, we find that they often stretch out into different categories. So if you take the Thousand and One Nights, for example, the Middle Eastern stories, a lot of those stories are about merchants. And there are many stories about sort of the trading class. And you find that in some European stories as well. I mean, one of the radical things about Beauty and the Beast, for example, is the fact that she's a merchant's daughter, not a princess. Although in the original version, she ends up being, in reality, the daughter of a fairy king. But that's a whole different aspect. But if you go into the Russian stories that were collected by Ivan Khodjakov and Alexander Afanasyev, they're generally stories of peasants because they were collected from the villages around Russia. But you get stories of people in different classes. There's a lovely story that I'm really fond of called Expensive Ivan, where he's a magician scammer and he gets turned into different animals. So he can turn himself into whatever animal he likes. So he turns himself into a horse and gets his dad to sell him at the market, and then they make the money. And then he turns himself into a cow and they make more money and so on. And so they end up building up this pile of gold. So actually, as you dig further into these stories, there are people from all kinds of different backgrounds and classes. But I think what's sad is that conventional society has very much curated this sort of limited collection of stories. And one of the things I wanted to do in the book was partly to look at the secret stories behind those very famous stories, but also to draw out some of these stories that have sort of fallen behind the back of the sofa in a way, and actually are many of them are more interesting. The characters are a little bit more complex and the scenarios that they're in are a little bit more layered. And that's the reason why they haven't been as successful in many ways, because, you know, I think the history of fairy tales is very much of the history of these of things getting compressed and narrowed down. Mm. But as we go deeper into the genre, we find that there is such richness there. It's this huge, huge sort of unlimited treasure chest with so much. Mm.
Just back to the word ogre, you use that to sort of signify baddies in general. But so what were the original ogres modelled on?
Well, obviously, there's different theories on all of these magical creatures. A lot of, one of the theories is that we're looking back into pagan times, and this is really the history of of Christianity pushing down the people who came before and the religions that came before, and people then being forced into the woods, into the forest. It's the same with witches, the idea of anybody who has some kind of occult knowledge. So ogres and witches, they're the people who have that special knowledge. They're often very close to nature, and that's the idea of nature worship. And so it's reflecting many of those ideas, but also in a more realistic sense in some ways. If you go to the Italian collection, where there's a lot of ogres by Giambattista Basile, he went around to many places around southern Italy where people used to live in caves, the people, especially around in the Basilicata region. And so you could argue that the ogres who appear in his stories actually are a reflection of the rural poor who were forced to live in caves. And so they were seen as these sort of troglodytes by the upper classes, but also that they had conserved a lot of knowledge. And so in a lot of Basile stories, it's the upper classes are twits, often. So take the story of the flea. The king is an idiot who has this flea grown to the size of a sheep and then says anybody who can identify it can marry his daughter. He's seen very much as a fool. And it's the ogre who comes into the court and is the only person who can identify it. And although he's an ogre, so he is, in the conventions of the story, the baddie, he's not necessarily bad within his own identity. So he wants to be a good husband to the princess. So when he takes her to his cave, he says, look, here's anything you like to eat. Here are the bones of dead men that I've crushed with my bare hands. Have them. I want you to have anything that will make you happy. And of course, that's not going to make the princess happy. She's not very happy about that at all. But he doesn't know that. He's an ogre, you know. So I think Basile has a lovely way of using the identity of ogres to poke fun at the court and the courtly class, and to point out that actually it's amongst the rural poor often that real wisdom is stored.
Mm. I'd like to zone in on a few of the tellers of the stories. And if you could tell us more about Hanna Diab.
Yeah, well, he was a fascinating character who lived in Syria, in Aleppo, and he met a French archaeologist called Paul Lucas and travelled with him across the Levant, across the Middle East, and then eventually to Europe and to France. And he was presented at the court of Louis XIV, the Sun King. And he came there with a pair of desert jabots from Tunisia, which were in a specially made cage. And he was presented in his traditional costume to the French court. And they thought he was fascinating, this figure from the Middle East. And at the time, there was a lot of interest in Middle Eastern culture. The 1001 Nights were being translated by Antoine Galland, who was a very talented French writer. And Hanna knew many of many tales, and he told more tales to Galland, and the tales that he told would become some of the most famous, I think, of them all: Aladdin and the Wonderful Lamp, Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, The Enchanted Horse, as well as stories that didn't even make it into the 1001 Nights but are brilliantly interesting, such as The Golden City. So there were many stories that he told, and they became part of a new volume of the 1001 Nights and spread all around Europe and became the most popular, and the ones that were then turned into theatrical adaptations, then eventually into movies much later on, and have really sort of kept going and surviving and become stock stories and the panto scene. But Hanna wasn't necessarily, he wasn't treated as well as he could have been when he was in France. And it's a complicated story because Antoine Galland, who took the stories from him, then adapted them in his own way, added his own flourishes to the story. And it can be difficult to tease out exactly what was Galland's contribution and what was Hanna Diab. So I think you have to sort of credit both of them for what they did. But Hanna was very much the person who gave the story, the template of the story, the structure of the story. And then Galland was worried that Hanna might become a rival for the role that he had in the French court and in literary society. So he sort of machinated against him, and Hanna ended up having to leave France and going back to Syria. And he never realised how much of a contribution he had made to world culture. He never realised how the stories that he had told were becoming so popular and how much they would survive forever. He thought of it as quite a trifle, really, in his very adventurous life. So I felt, as soon as I heard about his story, I felt really felt for him as somebody who didn't realise how much he had done, what an amazing contribution he'd made. And he had this amazing life, and he put it down in a memoir, which was found only very recently in the 1990s by a French scholar called Jérôme Lantin, and has since been published. And it's a fantastic way of finding out about the life of this storyteller. And with a number of them, there are memoirs or letters or correspondences that enable us to go back into their lives. And that was something that I was very keen on, to see their lives on their level through their memories and those of their contemporaries, to try as much as possible go to those primary sources and understand them through those.
And I know that one that particularly fascinates you is the Russian storyteller.
Yes, Ivan Khodjakov. He's a fascinating figure, and he's been barely mentioned in Western European literature, because the stories that he told, he collected a range of stories around the villages of Russia. He grew up in Siberia. He went to university at Kazan. He was quite a misfit, and he didn't get on with the people around him. At school, he wrote in his memoir that he thought everybody was singing all the time and just enjoying themselves and thinking too much about sex. And he was quite a serious figure. But he went around collecting all these stories. And there were stories about Baba Yaga, the witch in a hut on chicken's legs, and Maria Maravna, this beautiful princess, and Hoshai the Deathless, who's this very eerie figure who you can't kill him directly. His death is hidden away inside an egg, which is inside a hare or a duck, inside a treasure chest under an oak tree. And there's sort of elements of Voldemort about him. And he's and there are many other sort of wonderful mythical characters. And he collected these stories together. He published a collection at the age of just 18 and went to Moscow and St. Petersburg and met people in the literary society of the time. But he had very very strong political convictions, and he, at the time, there was so much upheaval going on in Russia with the emancipation of the serfs, with literature really flourishing, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Turgenev all writing their masterpieces at that time, but also a sense of a sort of a cultural explosion in Russia, gazettes and newspapers and periodicals coming out, ideas being disseminated all over the place. And for the elites, that was very worrying, and so they were pushing back against it. And Ivan was part of a group that felt that the only way that things could be changed with something really radical. And one of them, who was an acquaintance of his, went and tried to kill the Tsar with a double-barreled flintlock pistol and shot at him outside the Summer Palace, and would have probably hit the Tsar if it hadn't been for a drunk hatter's apprentice who jogged his arm just at the moment that he was shooting, and the bullet went into the pavement. And so this guy Karakozov was taken in and taken to prison, and then a trial took place, and there was a hunt for all his acquaintances, and Ivan was one of those who was taken in. And as soon as the prosecutor started putting their case together, and it was the first time that the convicts were, or the suspects were given their own attorney, so it was a big moment in Russian legal history. But his lawyer said to him, "I really don't know how I'm going to get through all the material they've got against you, let alone be able to defend you," because they weren't just trying him for his acquaintance with the would-be assassin, but also for all the things he'd written, for the folk tales he'd written, which they thought was suspect because that was going to the ordinary people and finding out. And in many of those stories, the czars and the ruling classes don't always come across as the most intelligent, but also because he'd written a book called A Tutorial for Learning to Read and Write, which doesn't seem very controversial to us. But at this time, many in the elite thought that this was completely beyond the pale, and it included excerpts. It was specifically for adults and for people coming out of the serf class who wanted to be literate. And it had examples from Darwin's Origin of the Species, which was seen as quite controversial by many in the Russian elite. So there was a count called Count Murayev who had it banned and prohibited. And then he was the judge in the trial. And so it didn't look good for Ivan. But he was given what was seen as clemency, which was that they executed the assassin, but he was just sent to the furthest part of Siberia, to a town called Verkhoyansk, which he measured as being the coldest town on Earth, -63.2 degrees Celsius, absolutely freezing. So, it makes you think that it's a lot warmer outside than we realise. but unfortunately, his mind went to pieces there, and he ended his life very sadly.
So no happily ever after.
No happily ever after for him. And that's why I felt so passionate about wanting to bring his story out, because he collected these amazing stories, and they are really, really colourful, magical tales. But obviously his life itself was quite a bitter one. And I think that's one of the sad things, that a lot of these storytellers, and this is the history of storytelling really, is a lot of these storytellers, they weren't very well treated by the political and the literary establishment of their day. They did, you know, have quite a hard time, and didn't necessarily end their lives knowing how much their work would be appreciated in the future.
Well, you've certainly opened up a whole new world to me. I mean, I will absolutely look at fairy tales in a totally different way.
Oh, thank you.
Nicholas, thank you so much for that fascinating look. The Fairy Tellers by Nicholas Jubber is published by John Murray Press, and it's out now. Nicholas, thank you so much. I'm wishing you happy ever after.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the producer Nora Hull and researcher Georgia Bispas. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.